From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, it's our annual end-of-the-year 10 Best Show. First, our rock critic Ken Tucker plays us his choices for the best records of the year. Then film critic Stephen Schiff presents his top 10 and looks at the state of Hollywood, independent film, and foreign films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might want to get out a pen and paper for today's show. Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker is here with his list of the 10 best records of 1994. And of course, he's brought along the records to play for us. Let's get started with a track from one of his top 10, a CD called What a Crying Shame by a group that's more country than rock, the Mavericks.
I loved you then, I love you still. I miss you, darling, I always will. Resign myself to feeling blue. Ain't found nobody since I
Ken, welcome back for our annual presentation of your 10 Best list.
Well, thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
Where do the Mavericks fit in pop music of 94?
Well, they fit in many ways. To me, the Mavericks aren't just a country band. They're a band that's a young band that's been equally influenced by rock and roll. I mean, you can hear Roy Orbison in the way that the lead singer, Raul Malu, sings. They cover a Bruce Springsteen song on this album. I just think that they're a wonderful combination of things, a very traditional sound to their country music, so much so that when the album first came out, it was considered probably just a critic's record and wouldn't appeal to a mass audience in this age of, you know, Reba McEntire, middle-of-the-road kind of pop country. But it was one of those examples of records that, which also happened in the rock industry this year, of albums that slowly built into being hits. It wasn't as if it was an immediate number one hit in Billboard's charts and sustained itself. This was a slow builder, and it eventually went gold. It's on its way to selling a million copies. Very similar to the situation with Sheryl Crow and her debut album, Tuesday Night Music Club. That record came out, faded away, but people started playing it. There was a kind of buzz about it. There were a few videos on MTV, and they gather audiences that way. So I think that the Mavericks, to me, embody that kind of trend of the slow build this year, and also the way Raul Malu writes or co-writes most of his material. I think he's a real throwback to that sort of strong singer-songwriter tradition of the 70s, updated for the 90s.
Well, several entries on your 10 Best list are singer-songwriters. Do you think that that just reflects your taste, or do you think that there are more and more singer-songwriters now in rock music that are making an impact?
Well, I think that there's a kind of expanded definition of a singer-songwriter these days. I mean, to me, the term means an artist who expresses his or her own sensibility, often through very autobiographical lyrics, and yet does it in the context of either as a solo artist or, in the case of the Mavericks, in a group context. And I think more and more you're getting that kind of very personal sort of writing and arranging and producing in a lot of the best of this music this year.
On your list is one of the originators of that singer-songwriter tradition, Joni Mitchell. What's her new record like?
I thought her new record was wonderful. It's called Turbulent Indigo. It didn't do very well. It peaked at number 47 on the Billboard charts. You know, as we talk, the year-end Billboard, it's languishing at number 186. You know, and I think it's finally a case where, you know, for years, there are many of us critics who said, oh, Joni, why don't you go back to the stuff you did best, that kind of singer-songwriter, folk-based melodies, you know, get away from that jazz stuff you're trying to pull off. And now she's done it, and there was no audience that came to her, to meet her on her own terms. And I think that that's terrible. I think it's a tragedy that this record wasn't recognized as much as it should have been. I think it's a really, really strong record for her.
Why don't you play something from the new Joni Mitchell album for us?
Yeah, I'd like to play a track called How Do You Stop?
That's Joni Mitchell, and with me is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and we're going over his picks for the best in pop music of 1994. Well, there's a couple of younger singer-songwriters on your 10 best list, Sam Phillips, Liz Phair. Do you think that the younger generations of singer-songwriters are heading in different directions than the singer-songwriters of the 70s?
Well, I think that they're certainly influenced by things that have come since the 70s, by punk, certainly, to a certain extent by rap music. And I think that singer-songwriters like Tori Amos and Sam Phillips and Liz Phair are combining that and using somebody like Joni Mitchell as a role model of somebody who's a real independent, didn't present herself as just a quote-unquote chick singer, aren't defined by their sexuality, and are writing real strong, forthright autobiographical lyrics, or in the case of Sam Phillips, these beautiful sort of pop melodies that don't worry about whether they're too soft or too harsh, or they're just a kind of creations of their own. I think that Sam Phillips' album, Martinis and Bikinis, is just a wonderful pop record that many people, it seems to me, a very broad-based record that, again, should have found a much wider audience than it did.
What would you like to play for us from it?
I'd like to play a track called Baby, I Can't Please You.
That's Sam Phillips, and her record is featured on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list for 1994. You know, Ken, it seems in pop music now, you know, like on the one hand, there's the singer-songwriters, often in a more acoustic setting. And then on the other hand, you have the kind of sons of punk and, you know, the grunge rock descendants and stuff. You know, real kind of loud, noisy, guitar-driven bands. Two, I think, pretty different directions.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly this year there's been this real nice revival of punk. I mean, punk has come back to work as an influence on a whole new generation of like 20-year-old kids who are just discovering it for the first time and really getting into old Sex Pistols and Clash records and stuff. So you have this phenomenon of bands like Green Day and Weezer and a duo called Ween. Just, you know, Green Day sold 3 million copies when you do that, you're not just hitting just punk rock fans. You're not just hitting 20-year-olds or teenagers. You're hitting adults who grew up on punk rock who really think there's something worthwhile to what these kids are doing. It's a much more broad-based sort of audience that you're hitting. And I think that's also true of a band like Pearl Jam, which came out of Seattle, part of that whole grunge scene, which is now either by the death of Kurt Cobain and many of this commercial success, you don't just think of them as that sort of niche band of Seattle grunge. It's become a much more of a broad-based pop band. What I really like about this Pearl Jam album called Vitalogy is that what's held me back before on them is Eddie Vedder, the lead singer. It seems so self-pitying. The music is so downbeat as to be almost a parody of kind of depressed singer-songwriter lyrics in the context of this loud rock and roll. This one, I love the way the guitars just frequently overpower his voice. His voice becomes just another one of the instruments that make this music sound really powerful and good. And you don't have to really follow the words. You know what the emotions are just by hearing the tone of his voice.
So what song do you want to play?
I'd like to play a cut called Corduroy.
That's Pearl Jam from their latest album, Vitalogy, one of the albums on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list. You want to play something else from the kind of loud category?
Sure.
Of your 10 Best list?
Loudness rules, man. yeah, an even younger band than Pearl Jam, a group of women called L7, put out an album called Hungry for Stink, which I thought really tapped into that sort of early Sex Pistols, British kind of punk, even though they're from L.A. The track I'd like to play is called Riding with a Movie Star, and you're going to notice that it's very nearly just an instrumental. What I really like about this, it's kind of like an all-purpose theme song. You know, if I was like living my life with a theme song accompanying me, I would want this driving piece of music behind me, and the only lyric is the title of the song. They just yell, Riding with a Movie Star.
I'm going to fight you for that theme. I like it, too.
Yeah.
Just kidding, Ken. You can have it for your theme.
Thanks.
Okay. This is L7. It's L7 from their album Hungry for Stink, one of the albums on Ken Tucker's 10 Best list. And I like that because it's so pop sounding. It's so...
Yeah, it's real accessible, even though it's got that kind of brutal guitar edge to it. It's still very accessible in its melody. I like it a lot.
Now, would you still call this alternative rock? And if this is alternative rock, then what's the mainstream now?
I think alternative has become the mainstream. I think that through, as usual, in this kind of pop culture situation, you have genuine quality that's also marketed very shrewdly, and it becomes a kind of music that many, many people want to hear. In this case, literally millions of people want to hear Pearl Jam's record, which, you know, went to number one immediately upon its release. That's fairly unthinkable even 5 years ago that a record this raw could go to that position on the charts so quickly. And so I think it's a combination of older rock fans thinking, oh, this is what's hip, this is what I'm going to investigate, and a combination of also the young audience to which that music is directly aimed. I mean, a lot of these musicians are in their teens and 20s, and it's aimed directly at their contemporaries. And so I think that the music is very strong in the sense that it attracts a rock audience that's not just a teenage audience, but an adult audience that's come to learn all these kinds of forms of rock and roll and don't find it alienating anymore. The whole idea of shocking your parents or alienating your parents with the music you play is becoming harder to do because your parents have grown up with that music and they get all the references.
Yeah, well, you're in that position of being one of those parents.
Sure. I mean, I think in a way rock and roll has become, an enormously subtle thing in the sense that while it's still a very elementary music and technically very crude and purposely so, there's a whole body of references now that when somebody listens to a Pearl Jam record, they're picking up on Led Zeppelin, on the Rolling Stones, on an entire history of music. They can hear the quotations and what's being done to them to make them original again.
We're reviewing the year in pop music with Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker. Time for a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're looking back on 1994 in pop music with rock critic Ken Tucker. What happened that interested you most in black pop this year?
Well, I thought there were some strong rap and hip-hop records this year. There was nothing that sustained an album enough for me to put an album on my list, but that there were some really strong debuts that, for one thing, last year I was bemoaning the rise of gangster rap in the sense that it seemed to me so misogynistic, so needlessly violent in its imagery. On the other hand, I thought it was a very valuable form in the sense that it really relayed what was going on in the world these days, and it was one of the few places in pop culture where those kinds of sentiments could be heard. I think that was continued this year with acts like Method Man, who's a guy from a very popular hip-hop band called the Wu-Tang Clan. He had a single called Bring the Pain this year, which was really strikingly dramatic and very forceful. I thought it was one of the best kind of rap singles. Another act, a guy called Nas, had an album called Illmatic, which I also thought was very good. I like the way a lot of black pop this year combined rapping and hip-hopping and rhythm and blues in a much more melodic way. Certainly someone like R. Kelly and Boyz II Men, and my personal favorite, this female trio TLC, who put out a record called Crazy Sexy Cool, which is like my album title of the year, I think. And their single off of that album called Creep, I think is just a wonderful, catchy, bouncy, yet hard-edged piece of music.
Why don't we hear it?
Good.
That's TLC. My guest is Ken Tucker, and we're talking about his picks for the best records in pop music 1994. Well, Ken, I think it's that time for you to actually read your list.
Okay.
Of the 10 best, 1994.
The Mavericks, What a Crying Shame. Sam Phillips, Martinis and Bikinis. L7's Hungry for Stink. Joni Mitchell's Turbulent Indigo. Pearl Jam's Vitalogy. Liz Phair, her album was called Whip Smart. Sugar, led by Bob Mould, and his record is called File Under Easy Listening. Oasis, a young British band, with their album called Definitely Maybe. Madonna, my wonderful beloved Madonna, I thought returned to form completely with her album Bedtime Stories.
Parentheses, Ken Tucker, the only person in America still willing to defend Madonna.
That's right. Well, you know, perversity has its virtues, I think. And finally, The Pretenders, who made a real strong comeback, I think, with Last of the Independents.
Great. You want to do your runners-up?
Sure. There were lots of strong country records, I thought, this year, including Mark Chestnut's album, What a Way to Live, and David Ball's Thinkin' Problem, and a Mike Henderson record that I thought got completely ignored called Country Music Made Me Do It. I liked the Sheryl Crow debut, Tuesday Night Music Club. I liked R.E.M.'s album, Monster. And I really like Richard Thompson's album called Mirror Blue.
Well, great. Ken, I wish you a very happy new year.
Well, same to you, Terry. Thanks.
And thanks a lot for sharing some of the best music of the year, or at least your picks for the best music of the year.
That's right. The two may not actually intersect, but I'm glad you had me anyway.
Let's go out with something. What would you like to play?
Well,
I
think a good way to combine two of my runners-up, there was an album that's a tribute to Richard Thompson of other artists covering his songs. The album is called Beat the Retreat, and R.E.M. did this really beautiful version of the Richard Thompson song Wall of Death.
Great. Well, let's hear it. And Ken Tucker is rock critic for Fresh Air. Happy New Year again, Ken.
Same to you.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's Dick Dale, the king of surf guitar, and his recording of Miserloo, now better known as music from the soundtrack of Pulp Fiction. Our film critic Stephen Schiff includes Pulp Fiction on his list of the 10 best films of 1994. We'll find out what the other nine are, and we'll review what happened this year in film, coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's countdown time again. Our film critic Stephen Schiff is with us with his list of the 10 best films of 1994. You might want to jot these down. Some of his favorite films may still be playing at a theater near you. Others you might want to rent when they come out on video. Why don't we start with number 10 on Stephen's list and work our way up?
Number 10 is Natural Born Killers, Oliver Stone's very controversial avant-garde story of two killers who are in love and on the lam. Number 9 is To Live by Zhang Yimou, the Chinese film that covers about 3 or 4 decades of Chinese life under Mao. Number 8 is Lady Bird, Lady Bird, which is Ken Loach's kind of searing, harrowing indictment of the British social services system, with a great performance by a newcomer named Chrissy Rock, probably, in my opinion, the female performance of the year. Number 7 is Quiz Show, Robert Redford's surprisingly good film about the quiz show scandals of the 50s, starring Ralph Fiennes and John Turturro. The next one is very obscure. It really only played in New York, in fact, for something like 3 weeks at one little theater, and didn't get to much of the rest of the country, and I thought it was an extraordinarily good film. It's called L627. It's a policier by Bertrand Tavernier that really gets at the grit of police work and the banality of police work in a way that many American films have tried to do but have not succeeded as well as I think Tavernier has. Then Nicholas Heitner's The Madness of King George, which is Heitner is making his film debut as a director, but he directed The Madness of George III on the stage, and this is the film adaptation of it, starring Nigel Hawthorne, who started in it on the stage, Alan Bennett's great play, made even better as a film. Number 4 is Hoop Dreams, the extraordinary nearly 3-hour documentary about two kids in the Chicago ghetto, a film made by Steve James, Frederick Marks, and Peter Gilbert. Number 3, Vanya on 42nd Street, Louis Malle's version of Andre Gregory's version of the Chekhov play, and a really sublime piece of movie making. Number 2, The Boys of St. Vincent by John N. Smith, Canadian director. And this film began for Canadian television and is a two-part film amounting to about 3 hours about a scandal, a semi-fictional scandal in a seminary and that involves child abuse. And it's an extraordinary piece of straight-ahead narrative filmmaking with a chilling performance by a newcomer named Henry Czerny. And number 1, this may not surprise people, but it really is a towering movie, I think, Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino.
Stephen, I'll bet you that a lot of our listeners have only seen 2 or 3 movies on your list, even very serious film goers, because a lot of these movies have never opened in a lot of places or haven't yet opened in many places.
I feel a little embarrassed about that, too. I mean, I
didn't mean to embarrass you.
That's all right. Oh, I'm blushing like crazy. I'm like a rose in here. No, I'm sorry about that, and I think there are two reasons. One, this is a very peculiar Christmas this year. We have a lot of films that opened that would ordinarily have opened around Christmas, opening very early in November, as Hollywood races to sort of get a bigger piece of the year-end pie and realizes that things are not quite so seasonal as Hollywood has traditionally made them. So that you had movies like Star Trek and Interview with a Vampire and Junior, big sort of year-end blockbusters opening before Thanksgiving. That made the Christmas season seem sparser, and a lot of the Christmas films were, as they say in the business, platformed, which means they open very slowly so that word of mouth gets to build and build and build, and then they go wider into more theaters in January. That's true of The Madness of King George, for instance, on my list. Some of these films are foreign films, like To Live and Lady Bird, Lady Bird, which is not a foreign language film, but which is a small British film, that will open very, very gradually all over the country. So yes, that's the problem. And some of them, like The Boys of St. Vincent, are doomed to remain obscure because of the subject matter and their length.
So I should say to our listeners that if there are films on this list that you haven't seen that you want to see, they might be opening up in January in a theater near you.
That is right.
All right. Well, Stephen, I'll tell you what, there's a lot more I want to talk with you about 1994 in film. But why don't we take a short break first?
Fine.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff, who's also critic at large for The New Yorker, and we're looking at the year 1994 in film. I've noticed lately that a lot of the art houses where you used to see mostly foreign films, you're now seeing a mix of foreign films and of independent films, independent American films. And more, I think those art houses are given over to the independent American films.
Yeah, I think that's right. And even when you do see foreign films, they're very often not foreign language films. They're English-speaking films, although they're from England or from Ireland or from Australia. And this was a discovery that was made sort of in the mid-'80s by foreign film distributors who were even then dwindling in number, which is that America does have an appetite for foreign films, but not for foreign language films. That appetite is tiny. And it must be said that the world cinema has also contracted and you know, you could do a chicken or the egg kind of analysis. In other words, has the audience contracted and therefore the cinemas have contracted, or is it just that there aren't very good filmmakers out there right now and therefore the audience has contracted? It's hard to say, but if you look at the French film industry, which once was an extraordinarily dominant influence, it's dwindled. If you look at Italian films, that's dwindled. The Japanese film industry is nearly dead. The Chinese film industry, of course, is a very important new influence, but it's a deeply embattled one. We're not getting much in the way of Indian films, et cetera, et cetera. The great German Renaissance is long over. So that's a sad state of affairs. And then when the films do come, they seem to have a limited and shrinking audience. That audience that delighted in foreign films many years ago is aging and is not being replaced by younger people. So you now have a situation where films that speak English, whether they're American independents or foreign films that speak English, are going into the art houses alongside the foreign films, and then they're tested there. And if they find an audience, those independent films move on to larger venues, and at the same time, their directors get seduced into the big Hollywood machine.
And it seems that Hollywood is scouting these young independent filmmakers more and more, and that they're getting scooped up more quickly than ever before by Hollywood when they're successful.
Even the ones that we haven't heard of. I mean, The Boys of St. Vincent, my number two pick of the year, by John N. Smith. I mean, maybe he made that name up, but actually there is a real John N. Smith who's been working on a very small scale in Canada for many years. The Boys of St. Vincent didn't go all over the country. It didn't get wide regard and acclaim, but John N. Smith, friends of his tell me, has just finished coming back from Disney and making a Michelle Pfeiffer movie. So the studios are on the lookout for new talent, and there are two sides to that coin. I mean, it's maybe it's not a coin, and maybe there are more sides to it. I mean, it's very nice to have young, exciting new filmmakers get opportunities and get paid and get famous. That's terrific. And if they can handle it, and if they can go back and forth, as someone like Quentin Tarantino says he would like to do, go back and forth between independent cinema and big blockbuster mainstream cinema, depending on what's appropriate for the topic of his film, that's just great. And I hope we can work that out. But very often what happens is someone is sucked into the giant maw and goes through a series of compromises and pretty soon doesn't know what's happened to him. That happened the first time, for instance, Neil Jordan came to Hollywood. He started making very bad Hollywood movies. Interview with a Vampire is not a movie I think very highly of, but it's at least more accomplished than what he made before returning back to England and Ireland and making The Crying Game on his own terms and then finding his own success again. That's one thing that happens. Another thing is that these young directors who are from the independent world are kind of fodder for the system because the age of the great auteur is sort of over in Hollywood. It's now the age of the lawyers, the accountants, the money men, the conglomerates, even the producers more than the directors. And it seems more and more possible to make films with a director who is basically a traffic director, a guy who you get out there, he knows something about the camera, he's made a film that's good and interesting, but that's not what you want him for. You want him there because someone needs to be the director, and this guy's cheap, and this guy's easy to manipulate, and he's not going to jockey for power, and he's not going to make something too stylish, and he's not going to make something that is going to deviate from the mainstream. So it's a way of crushing the life out of people who may potentially develop into bigger talents if they stay away from Hollywood.
I think a lot of producers believe that the only way you can make a big movie is if you have a bankable star. But this is one of those years where even the bankable stars aren't always bankable. Who are some of the stars that had the big names but didn't get the big box office this year?
Well, you know, I mean, this idea of movie stars is always so funny because every year, you know, wise men sort of say, you know, there are only four movie stars and they're this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy. Then the next year, all those guys flop and they say, you know, now there are only really four movie stars. And Arnold Schwarzenegger flopped in Junior, as he had flopped in Last Action Hero the previous year. Kevin Costner flopped and flopped and flopped in Wyatt Earp in The War. Julia Roberts flopped in I Love Trouble. Stallone, I don't know whether people still think he's a star, but I mean, it was that kind of year. Some stars did not flop. Tom Hanks did not. Tom Cruise did not. But I thought it was very possible that Tom Hanks could show up in a movie that, you know, people didn't want to see him in, and he could go down the tubes, and just his name on a marquee wouldn't mean anything. And that's the definition of what a star is. A star is someone who, just by the appearance of that name on a marquee, is going to draw you in. And it seemed to me that there was only one star, therefore, this year.
Who would that be?
And that was Jim Carrey, of all people. Now, Jim Carrey is a really strange phenomenon. He was in three hit movies this year, and last year he was in nothing. He hadn't even occurred yet. I've been sort of watching him on television and whatnot for a long time, and I'm fascinated by him. You know, if this is a year that in some ways celebrates dumbness, and certainly, you know, the year's big movie was Forrest Gump, a movie about how nice it is to be dumb. Jim Carrey is a little bit the flip side of that. He's always playing a dumb guy, but he's also playing a kind of shrewdly dumb guy. He's a sort of a rubber-faced shtick comic in a long tradition that goes back to, you know, Harpo Marx, Joey Brown, and Jerry Lewis. And like all those comics, his stock in trade is anarchy. But I think what makes him kind of our rubber face, you know, or a rubber face for the 90s, is that he's ironic. He's facetious. He is, you know, Jerry Lewis, Joey Brown, these guys were not facetious. They were, you know, what you saw was what you got. Like David Letterman, Jim Carrey is so knowing, is so kind of in on the joke with you, so self-reflexive. That is a very fin de siècle 90s thing. And I think it may portend well for him. I think he may last.
The box office phenomenon of the year was Forrest Gump. What do you make of the success of that film?
Well, From the moment we all saw it, and I saw it very early, I said, I see, this isn't a film, this is a religion. And I think that's really what was happening. And why this religion? I think what Forrest Gump says is, okay, let's go through the decades that we of the baby boom generation have gone through. We go through the 50s, we go through the 60s, we go through the 70s, we go through the 80s, and we see what rocked us and what sort of assaulted us and how difficult everything was and how impossible to digest everything was. And We all feel that. That's something that, that an entire generation and beyond shares in common. And at the same time, we see people around us sort of all the time being pundits about these things, telling us what to think, telling us what opinions we should have, telling us information we didn't have. We're in an information age, and that information is important. We see people around us who are very glamorous, who seem to have presided over these, you know, cataclysmic events in a way that we feel inadequate to. So all around us are these things that we are not equal to, and these people whom we are not equal to, and we feel overwhelmed. And then along comes a movie that says, hey, forget the whole thing. You can be dumb. You can be stupid. You can be you can be dumb as long as you're decent. And if you are decent and if you are nice, then love will come, riches will come. You don't have to understand a thing. Just go with the flow. Just be sweet. I think that's a kind of a message of salvation and redemption for a not very ambitious public, and it worked.
I don't imagine that you're going to a movie on New Year's Eve.
No, I'm actually not going to a movie on New Year's Eve.
No, you'd have to be taking notes if you did. That wouldn't
right.
be fun at all.
Wouldn't not necessarily.
Well, for those of us who plan on staying home and renting videos, do you want to maybe talk about some of your favorite films of all time that just might be available on video?
Oh, my favorite films of all time. Well, this is always hard. And if someone asks me, and many people do ask me, what my favorite film is, it changes week by week. This week I'm in a mood for Seven Samurai. That is one of the greatest films of all time and could occupy you for many happy New Year's Eve hours.
Just be warned, it's subtitled. If
yes.
you're watching it on video,
oh,
it's
I'm
a
sorry.
Little hard to read.
A lot of what I'm about to name is something, because the next one I was going to say was Rules of the Game. I mean, if you can't go to a New Year's Eve party, the best party on film is Rules of the Game. I mean, it is just, well, it's just magic from start to finish.
So what are you doing New Year's Eve, Stephen?
I'm partying, babe.
Well, have a really good time.
Same to you, Terry.
Happy New Year.
Thanks.
And thanks for talking about the year in film with us.
Pleasure.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic, and he's critic at large for The New Yorker. Let's hear the now famous twist scene from Pulp Fiction, Stephen's pick for the best film of the year.
Ladies and gentlemen, now the moment you've all been waiting for, it's a world famous Jack Rabbit Slim's twist contest. Now let's meet our first contestants here this evening. Young lady, what is your name?
Mrs. Mia Wallace.
And how about your fella here?
Vincent Vega.
All right, let's see what you can do. Take it away.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
This is Fresh Air. There were shootings at two abortion clinics in Massachusetts today. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. This happened at two clinics in Brookline, a Boston suburb. A man started shooting with a rifle. Several people were injured. Two women have died. David Wright of member station WBUR will have that story. Other reports, Newt Gingrich now says he will give up his $4.5 million advance on a book deal. He'll just earn standard royalties instead. Joe Palca has some scientific advice for hangover victims, but there's not really much help available. In the spirit of 1995, we will plant some tiny shamrock bulbs, and Bob Mondello goes back over his favorite 10 movies of 1994.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's zillions of songs that have been written for the holidays, but most of them are for Christmas, fewer for New Year's. This is the best New Year's song that I know. It's by Frank Lesser, who wrote the songs for Guys and Dolls. Let's hear Carol Sloan singing What Are You Doing New Year's Eve?
Maybe it's much too early in the game. Ah, but I thought I just the same. What are you doing, New Year's? New Year's Eve. I wonder whose arms will hold you good and tight when it's exactly 12 o'clock that night, welcoming in the new year, New Year's Eve. Maybe I'm crazy to suppose I'd ever be the one you chose out of a thousand invitations you'll receive. Ah, but in case I stand one little chance, here comes the jackpot question in advance. What are you doing, New Year's? New Year's Eve.
Carol Sloan singing the Frank Lesser song, What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? Well, it's time for Fresh Air to sign off for 1994. Well, I'm not going to get too sentimental on you, but I do want to thank you for tuning us in 1994, and I'm looking forward to spending more quality time with you in 95. Happy New Year from all of us at Fresh Air. Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurrock, Dorothy Farabee, Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, Becky Cohn, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Bentham. Special thanks to Marty Moss-Cohen, Fred Landerl, Sue Spolin, Joan Tuohy, Barbara Bogave, Chris Burgin, Kathy Wolf, Nancy Greenlease, Richard Parker, Bob Balls, and Chris Fraley. And to everyone at WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, especially Fred Brown and David Othmer. I'm Terry Gross. I'll talk with you next year.
Hello.
Hello.
Mr. New Year. Hello. Oh, yes. We welcome you here. We'll wipe our tears of yesterday, for a new year has come our way. It's true, Mr. New Year, it's true. The love we see through you will fill our imagination and give us inspiration.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.